This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham.
ISU scholar Megan Burke says the American ideal of rugged individualism doesn't help cure racism.
Individualism is simply not the only way that we can understand how and why we still have segregated communities, how and why there are persistent disparities in just about every measure of social outcomes.
Burke talks with John Norton about colorblind racism. Mary Cullen reports on that infamous Gillette ad and the perils of toxic masculinity. And John Norton catches up with Stone and Snow about their big trip to L.A. All that after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. An Illinois Wesleyan University sociology professor says fighting against racism requires more than simply ignoring race. Megan Burke's latest book, Colorblind Racism, argues that the well-intentioned trend of colorblindness, or disregarding the importance of an individual's race, does not, in fact, lead to racial equality. GLT's John Norton caught up with Burke to discuss how colorblind racism manifests itself in American society.
The way I like to talk about colorblind racism is that it reflects a belief that racism is a thing of the past, and that any way that we might understand what is clearly demonstrated, perpetual, persistent racial inequality in the United States is either explained by individual merits or lack thereof, or what I always say we imagine to be true about our own or each other's cultures. So the colorblind aspect is in an unwillingness to really grapple with the ongoing realities of racism, and that itself can become racist because it helps us to continue to participate in those systems that perpetuate racial inequality.
You hinted at individualism. That is key to this, right?
Absolutely.
This country is built on rugged individualism, mm-hmm. and everybody looks at themselves, at least white people historically, as if I work hard enough, I can do anything.
That's right.
Within reason. How does that factor into colorblind racism?
I think it factors in a number of ways. The first is that, and I think this is really important for us to recognize, that is a cherished ideal. It would be a beautiful society where the only thing that mattered really was our own merit, our own talent, our own hard work. I think that's part of the reason that that is so important to us culturally as Americans. I think for many white folks, it's easy for us to assume that that is indeed all that is going on in shaping our successes or our lack thereof. What we're less able to see for a whole variety of reasons are the ongoing realities of racial privileges and the ways that a long history of overt and covert racism has shaped society in a way where individualism is simply not the only way that we can understand how and why we still have segregated communities, how and why there are persistent disparities in just about every measure of social outcomes in the United States. So I think it's an important ideal for us, and we don't want to let that go in a way. But when we take that as the only sort of common sense way to understand how and why we still have these very real problems, we get stuck. And colorblind racism, I think, reflects that way of thinking.
Was it the civil rights movement itself that we went from overt to covert racism?
Yeah, that's often seen as a turning point in the way that we tend to talk and think about race in the United States. And in some ways, that's very understandable. I mean, it was the collective work of decades of struggle in the civil rights movement that helps us to eradicate some of the formal, perfectly legal, de jure forms of racism, for example, that made it perfectly legal to discriminate in housing and public spaces and all of those kinds of things. So the civil rights movement, the freedom movement, as it was often known at the time, was crucial in eradicating some of that availability for us to perpetuate formal overt racism. I think what we have done is assumed that that was all that was necessary and that that might alone kind of get us back to a level playing field. And we know, of course, that that's simply not the case.
There were overt forms of racism before the civil rights movement, but you argue in your book that there were definitely covert or colorblind racism itself, even if it was undefined at the time, way before the civil rights movement as well, right?
That's right. And I think that that's sometimes what our scholarship and our discourse around it has also missed. So colorblind racism is sometimes referred to as the new racism, but there were examples of colorblind racism being used in the 1800s and certainly for much of the 1900s, even up to the civil rights movement.
Can you give an example from the 1800s?
Yeah, absolutely. So this isn't exactly the 1800s, but an example I often use with my students is our 1924 Immigration Act, where we actually went to census data from the 1800s and made a law that said that we were going to restrict immigration to the United States based on a flat percentage, 2%, of any of the immigrants that were in the country in the 1880 census. That looks fair on the surface.
Well, that's
right?
40 years difference.
Well, exactly. And I think that what we what makes that colorblind racism is that by the 1920s, there was such extreme anxiety about certain groups of immigrants, in particular Asians and those from Southern and Eastern Europe. In the 1880 census, we had far higher numbers of Western and Northern European immigrants. And so what that did, by allowing an allegedly even percentage of immigrants in a quote-unquote colorblind fashion, was really help us to institutionalize racial preferences for immigrants from Northern and Western Europe.
And I can think of a housing incident where both covert and overt were being used around the same time, right? Housing covenants and neighborhood associations or neighborhoods that didn't allow people of color, especially black people, into the neighborhood on the argument that it lowered property values, right? So it wasn't a color argument.
Yes, that's a great example. So when we say, well, it's not that I'm racist, it's just that I want to protect my property values, or it's not that I'm racist, I'm just fearful of X, Y, or Z. That is allowing us to use what is sort of a classic line of colorblind racism, which is to take anything but race, anything but racism path to trying to understand or explain, or as I often say, explain away the realities of racism, either past or present.
Dr. Megan Burke, Associate Professor of Sociology at Illinois Wesleyan University, our guest here on GLT Sound Ideas. We're talking about her new book, Colorblind Racism. I'm John Norton. You heavily reference Eduardo Bonilla Silva in your book, his 2000 book, Racism Without Racists, Colorblind Racism and the Persistence of Racial Inequality in America.
That's an academic title for you.
Okay. Well, he identified four central frames for identifying colorblind racism that you outlined in here as well. Can you briefly explain those four frames and why they're important?
Yeah, I'll start with why they're important. I think they're important because they are ways that we have learned to interpret racial phenomena in the United States, and they reflect very common kinds of discourse, so the way that we talk and think about race in the United States. And so think about to the extent to which you hear these show up in our understandings of race and the way that people talk about it. The first is what is called naturalization. And what that tends to do is to say, well, it's only natural. This tends to happen most often with segregation. And so we say, well, it's only natural that, let's say, Asian immigrants want to live near other Asian immigrants, and that's why we have a Chinatown. Now, it's true that immigrant communities do form important networks to help acclimate newcomers and to share resources and to maintain cultural identity and all of that kind of thing. But what that even misses is the realities of extreme racism against Asians, past and present, certainly in the past, that made it so that that was the only option. So it ignores segregation. Another is called abstract liberalism, and it's just as we were talking about. It's that strong belief that we already have a fair and equal society and an even playing field, and on that basis says that it really must just then be the fault or the credit of the individual that may explain individual success or failures.
Okay.
The third is what I think most strongly echoes overt forms of racism from the past, but it still tends to do so in a colorblind way, and that is called cultural racism. So that's us saying, you know, again, using the example of Asians, that, you know, Asian culture somehow just inherently values and teaches their kids to value education and hard work. It says that, you know, whites often do the same, and it uses really tired, pretty racist tropes about black Americans, for example, to explain relative lack of attainment in education, employment, just about every measure. So it blames culture or credits culture without, again, seeing the realities of structural, institutional racism and ongoing bias. The fourth does what they all do, but it does so a little bit more directly. It's the minimization of racism. And so that lets us say, well, it's not race, it's social class, or, you know, it's not racism. We simply have a preference for this type of admissions criteria or whatever it might be in an institutional setting. And so it does so directly. It says, I'm not a racist, the past is the past, those kinds of things.
I want to ask you about a couple of other institutions where especially colorblind racism still exists, and it once surprised me was healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
How does colorblind racism manifest itself in healthcare?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you've always got these two ends of it. One is unevenness in availability to seek quality care and to receive it. So do you have a job that carries benefits that allow you to access health? So there's that structural institutional side of things. There's also, of course, plenty of well-meaning medical practitioners who still carry assumptions about even things like pain tolerance. There's been studies that indicate that doctors and nurses and other health professionals may assume that Black folks have a higher pain threshold and so may be less likely to trust their own narratives about their bodies and the pain that they're experiencing. It can often carry with it assumptions about behaviors that may signal healthy or unhealthy behaviors and willingness to be able to provide certain kinds of care in response to that. And so it really is pervasive. And that's a depressing thing to recognize. But that's exactly the point, is we have to be able to sit with those uncomfortable truths in order to move forward.
Policing as an institution has certainly gotten a lot of attention in the last 4 or 5 years, especially whether you want to call it colorblind racism or just blatant racism.
Sure.
Was the killing of Michael Brown in 2014 in Ferguson, was that a turning point as far as education, as far as awareness, maybe for white people?
You know, I haven't looked at that empirically, but I think, again, anecdotally, and the way that I'm hearing conversations begin to shift and change around me, as I'm sure you have as well, I do think it has been. I mean, I think for communities of color, it was nothing new. There does come a breaking point, and we have seen movements throughout history that respond to that kind of breaking point. The killing of Emmett Till, of course, is a great example of that as well, that launched the civil rights movement. So I do think that there is a rising awareness among, as you say, and I think this is correct, many white folks to really have to look hard at the realities of bias and discrimination and the way that that manifests in life or death situations like use of force among police officers. And so I think that the conversation in some ways is beginning to change, but I still think that we lack some of the tools to really meaningfully handle that because we're so heavily socialized, these colorblind ways of thinking and talking about race.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton with Dr. Megan Burke, Illinois Wesleyan University, professor of sociology. We talked about rugged individualism and we talked about structural racism and how they, you know, intersect, so to speak. But your research showed that, especially maybe in the last few years, Black people, especially, you know, maybe 3/4, if I'm getting the number right, believe that there is structural racism and that it's still a problem. But even white people, like over 50% of white people now, are thinking there is a problem. Yet when you boil it down, even Black people still cling to the rugged individualism that if something goes wrong, maybe because they didn't work hard enough.
Right.
Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, and it's
because they don't go together.
That's right, and it's such complicated territory. But I think it, on a basic level, it simply reflects the fact that we share a culture, that we share a society, that we, by and large, consume the same media, that even as partisanly divided as we are today, that both major political parties still draw on the same kind of discourse. And so we all learn to internalize that blame. We all also must still put forth our best foot. So it's not as though an emphasis on structural and institutional racism means that individuals don't have to work hard and don't have to utilize their talent and don't have to do everything possible. That, in a way, becomes all the more important, actually, for those who are constrained by systems of racism. And so there is a strong effort among really all communities, but particularly within marginalized communities, to teach each other that. and at the same time to internalize that as the only answer, because it is what is so predominant in our culture. And so I think that it's actually less of a contradiction than it might sound. It just indicates that we're in the same culture, we're in the same society, and yet we're up against different constraints.
If I'm a white person, what is the argument that even though I benefit from racism, I need to change the system? Other than a moral argument, right? Other than a religious argument, is there an economic argument that white people should care that white privilege is a thing in our country?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that in some ways it echoes the idea that a rising tide raises all ships. I know that's a little bit of a tired trope and it doesn't work perfectly. But, you know, if we were to really struggle for a society that was really fair for all and that really attended to the very real problems at the margins, then that's only going to further help everyone.
How do you get someone who, as I kind of said earlier, how do you get someone who just doesn't care that race still matters because they're in the majority and it doesn't really, to them, affect them?
You know, that's a great question. In some ways, I'm spoiled. When I work with students, I have, you know, the shortest amount of time I have is 3 full days to work with students. And most often I have 15 weeks in a semester. You know, I write books about this that I get to spend years on and hoping that someone will take the time to pick it up and read it. You know, I think in passing conversations, it's a little bit more challenging. And I think you also signal what has also been called racial apathy, which is related but somewhat different. So apathy says, I don't care. This doesn't affect me. But I think that's getting to be a harder and harder position to hold as movements do the good work of helping us recognize the realities of ongoing racism and bias, seeing it as a life or death matter, as the Black Lives Matter movement, for example, has done in movements long before it also have. You know, I think we have to be able to recognize people's shared humanity and the common goals that I think many of us have across the political spectrum, and to speak to people's best selves and the person that they want and need to be, to have good careers, to forge meaningful relationships in their families and their communities. And so I actually remain pretty hopeful, but this is what makes society complicated, is that that's never going to be uniform.
That's Megan Burke, professor of sociology at Illinois Wesleyan University, speaking with GLT's John Norton about her new book, Colorblind Racism. There's a community event planned related to the book at the Normal Public Library on April 1st. It's co-sponsored by Not in Our Town and the Black Lives Matter Book Club. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable financial management with an independent perspective. Drake Zimmerman has been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. A recent Gillette advertisement on the best a man can get highlights the various ways that men interact with the Me Too movement, pointing to acts of sexual harassment, bullying, and other typically male-centric behaviors. GLT's Mary Cullen speaks with ISU Women's and Gender Studies professor Tanya Diaz-Kozlowski about the conversations around toxic masculinity.
The internet ad has received both positive and negative feedback, some on social media calling it insulting to men for falling into the trap of typical stereotypes, some men going as far as throwing away their Gillette shaving products. So what's your take on this whole Gillette ad controversy?
Well, I think there's a lot of things. I think we're in a moment right now where the world is continually trying to figure out what it means to be an activist. Like, how do we do activism, if you will? And so I think the ad really speaks to, like, what are the political consequences of civic engagement and activism being defined by the logics of a marketplace? We've been here before. You know, we have other companies that have been engaging with the public about what does it mean to be a person and a consumer, you know? So this isn't new per se, but I think the way that people are engaging in the conversation, particularly that we have all of this new media and a new generation, right, who is engaging with activism, that really needs to be taken into consideration when we talk about what is the Gillette ad and what is it doing. Because Gillette's a company. Their goal is to make money. Now, that doesn't mean that what they're doing is bad. That also doesn't mean what they're doing is good. So I think one of the things we need to be really cognizant of is how to frame the conversation of what we're doing so that we don't alienate folks. Because really saying, is it good or bad? Are you for it? Are you against it? That's a moot point. That's very dichotomous thinking. I think to say, oh, it's really dramatic to throw your razors away, or, oh, this is the best thing ever, really limits the kind of discussions that we should be having. And then how are we going to continue to have these conversations about toxic masculinity and patriarchy and how all people participate in patriarchy? Because it's a sociopolitical system. It's not an individual man or a group of men. Now, do men participate in patriarchy? Yes, they do. Is toxic masculinity problematic? Yes, it is. Now, again, if you're offended by Gillette in their commercial, then I'm a little concerned, because the ad itself is trying to speak to men in particular by saying, hey, who are we as a group? We need to recognize these things.
And so these conversations that people either are having or might be having about the Gillette ad, and the conversation about how to tackle toxic masculinity in all forms and the patriarchy in all forms, how do you see people starting that conversation? Say, you know, there's a lot of negative energy out there, not just about the Gillette ad, but just toxic masculinity in general. And it tends to be a very attacking term for some males. And so how do you see an appropriate conversation on such a hot button topic?
Well, there's no one approach. Context is really important. Again, like I tell my students, I think that we have really interesting opportunities now because of technology, Twitter and Facebook and Tumblr and all these other social media forums. I don't think they're a primary place to have really meaningful, ongoing conversations because it's limited. So, you know, you're going to start with your top five. I like to say, you know, tell me who your top five people are. And so who do you surround yourself with? And those people you're going to have conversations with, you know, your peer groups, the organizations that you belong to, when you go out for dinner with folks, who is in your family, who are your friends. You know, we see, who do you go to the gym with? Do you play intramurals? Do you have kids? Do you go to the daycare? All of these sort of places that we interact with each other, we can have little conversations, right? But having longer, sort of more in-depth conversations with folks you might be in a more platonic or romantic relationship with, I think that's where we see sort of this deeper level, as well as, again, the opportunity, whether it's in the community, at a community center, whether it's at a community college or university, or at your church, to have conversations about what does it mean to be a gendered human being in society in 2019. Those are really meaningful. Again, our educational institutions have an array of resources where folks can come in that have been studying this, that know what toxic masculinity is. It's not just a word that was made up by feminists, right? Or to say, like, feminism is a bad word. It's not a bad word, but it's been stigmatized. So we have to be able to confront language, right? But we also have to look at the power relationships and who gets to decide what the language is. And so that's really important, number one, to start with vocabulary. We have to be able to say, okay, like the way you've been operating, you think feminism is XYZ. Feminism is the collective struggle to end sexist oppression. So you can identify individually as a feminist, or you can advocate feminism. But then you have to admit sexism exists. And a lot of people don't know what it is, or they may feel it, but they don't have, again, the vocabulary to talk about it. So then it just becomes something that is a buzzword, and it doesn't get interrogated. And then it just stays on a very individual level. And we have to find better places for us to be able to talk about it and make some difficult decisions.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen, speaking with Dr. Tanya Diaz-Kozlowski. She's an ISU professor in the Women's and Gender Studies program. So the Gillette ad actually came out right after the American Psychological Association released their first ever guidelines for treating male clients. Mm-hmm. So that's clients who are going in to seek psychological help. Mm-hmm. In essence, it's basically calling out the implications of toxic masculinity and the patriarchy on the mental health of men. Mm-hmm. And report says that men are benefiting from the patriarchy, but they're also impinged upon it. So for starters, could I have you define what even is the patriarchy?
Okay. Patriarchy, I'm using bell hooks. She's a Black feminist scholar. So patriarchy is a sociopolitical system that insists that males are inherently dominating, superior to everything and everyone deemed weak, especially women, and endowed with the right to dominate through violence. So we can see from that definition that that is extremely negative, but there's some really key pieces to that. Number one would be the male-centeredness. The second would be control, and then the third would be domination. So, and that it's a socio-political system. So it's not just a group of guys that are like, oh, I'm going to do this. It inherently benefits men, right? So that's something that, again, you have to face whether you like it or not. You're a part of this. So women also enact patriarchy because we internalize these things, right? So we have to unlearn things. So patriarchy gives us this system, and it informs how we understand ourselves as a gendered being in the world, and then how we create relationships with one another, right? So I think what the APA is trying to do, although I have to throw a little shade, they're a little late to the party. I think they're trying to engage in this because, I mean, their first paragraph, their statistics, that should be very concerning to every person on Earth, that men commit 90% of homicides. But again, women of color and women of color feminists know this. We have been saying this for years, and trying to get men involved in the, anti-gender violence movement, because we know that the majority of people who are committing violence are men. And that includes little boys and little girls, and folks of all genders are often suffering at the hands of older adult males. So rather than saying, well, how can we protect women and how can we have more emergency lights on the quad and, you know, let's do a safe walk program, we need to be interrogating why is it that the majority of the violent crime is being committed by men? And if you don't have the vocabulary and you're kind of like feel attacked in that way, that's a good indicator, right, that you're like, wow, there's something going on that I don't have the vocabulary for and I feel like maybe this has something to do with me. Maybe you need to be engaging it in a different way and a healthier way. And maybe you should sit back and listen and have some empathy. You know, you don't see women throwing away their razors or saying, we're not going to do these things. But we also get messages about what it means to be a woman in this society and what that means. And it's also harmful for us. And so I think that's really important to recognize. And I think the APA, they're trying their best. But there's some things, you know, they don't define patriarchy in the article. They don't define sexism. And then they also don't define what toxic masculinity is.
That was exactly my next question. How would you define toxic masculinity?
So again, toxic masculinity is also kind of a like everyday, like colloquial term for hegemonic masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
So hegemonic is just like a bougie word for power and dominant, you know? So if you want to be fancy and you're at a party, you'd be like, that hegemonic masculinity is just crap. You know, what's up with that? And so there's really four pieces to it. And the first one is repudiating the feminine, okay? The second would be the sexual objectification of women. The third would be that men are socialized to think and know that they cannot and should not express emotions. But when they do express those emotions, it's in a violent and unhealthy manner and in an explosion, if you will. There's certain parameters when it's all right for men to show emotion, but that's very, very guarded. There's a specific criterion for that. And then the last thing is to maintain gender subordination. Right. And so there's this relationship between men and women in particular, where women are, again, if we think about sexism, a set of beliefs that says that women are devalued and men are privileged. The gender subordination allows that relationship to be naturalized and normal. Right. So something really simple, for example, that seems harmless, like, oh, I'm going to walk through the door and I'm a woman and a man sees me and says, oh, I'll hold the door for you. Now, he's just being nice. He could open the door for me. But underneath that, if we could dig deeper to that, is, well, that's a part of me being that person being a man and saying, I'm going to open the door for you because that's what men should do. And women are inherently inferior and less strong than men. And so these are the practices that we associate to those kinds of behaviors and understanding of ourselves. So in order to break that, again, we have to have the vocabulary, but also be willing to change. Toxic masculinity can be unlearned, but you have to be willing to recognize that this, a man box, if you will, what it does, and that it's actually harmful. It's harmful to people of all genders, but it has different impacts and effects for women than it does for men.
Actually, in that study, it kind of goes along with some of those themes that you mentioned with the pillars of what is toxic masculinity. Mm-hmm. So the APA study goes on to say that men are often reluctant to admit vulnerability. Often men are raised to be self-sufficient, like we were just saying, mm-hmm. and they shield out any thoughts or emotions that people might define as weak. So in what ways are traditionally feminine behaviors different, and how is the collision of traditionally feminine behaviors compared to traditionally masculine behaviors? How is that collision impacting society?
Hmm. That's a big question. Well, I think in some of the things that you described, we can see these pieces of patriarchy and how they're embedded. Again, I think for me, it goes back to this notion of, you know, we're raising young people and also policing ourselves as adults, if you will, within this gender binary. And so when you have human beings that do not fit into these neat categories, there's going to be problems. There's going to be unhealthy practices and also violence. So I think the collision is happening on the micro scale and the macro scale, with relationships, large scale sort of people not being able to express themselves, on the large scale in institutions as well. I guess I don't think this collision, as you would put it, has just started. Because again, all people have these different characteristics in what we might describe as masculine and feminine. And so how that is received in the world as we're social beings, that will continually change. You know, like in the 1950s, if a baby was born and then it's assigned a sex and then that becomes a gender status, that baby might have been wrapped in a girl might have been wrapped in a blue blanket. But today, everything that's blue is associated with boys. So we know that these things are socio-historical concepts that will change, and that change because people changed. Right? People made those changes and decisions and institutions change, so it's a process. So I think the one thing that's underneath that is that we need to continually change and dismantle these things that are unhealthy and have horrible consequences.
If we're having these conversations now, what's the hope for the future?
I think many things. Some things are unknown. But I think, like I tell my students, if you can't imagine the world to be different than it is, it won't be. So that creativity and that imagination and the hope that the world can be a more equitable and just place, that we have to continually use that as a practice and have that, and not like fall into despair or say, oh, it is what it is. I think that we all can kind of get that way, but really we need to continually have hope as well as put folks that are in positions not just of power, but who can contribute to changing our society to make it more just and equitable.
That was GLT's Mary Cullen addressing the patriarchy with ISU Women's and Gender Studies professor Tanya Diaz-Kozlowski. This is Sound Ideas.
It starts out as a flicker, just a glimpse of an idea, maybe a question. But then the GLT newsroom works the phones, checks into it, and it turns out it's more than an idea. It's a good idea. Will concussion concerns prevent small-town schools from fielding football teams?
We just had to be the parents and say no.
From idea to story to your eyes and ears, this is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Hear the top NPR and local GLT news stories handpicked just for you right now on the NPR One app. Listen to GLT newscasts and our biggest stories on demand, or settle in for some podcast listening. You can even customize your favorite types of stories. NPR One has it all. Think Spotify or Pandora for news. This is GLT.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Later in the show, John Norton catches up with Stone and Snow ahead about their big trip to L.A. But first, giving a houseplant as a gift raises some questions. What kind of plant to give? Is the person receiving it even capable of caring for it? Illinois State University's Patrick Murphy has answers to those and other questions from GLT's Mike McCurdy in this episode of our gardening podcast, Grow.
Plants are often gifted all year to commemorate a birth, a death, a new house, or a new job. So what makes a good houseplant, and what should you consider? I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert, Patrick Murphy, from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. How are you doing, Murph?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing really great. So before we decide to give a plant, do we need to think about the person receiving that plant, whether they have a brown thumb or a green thumb?
I think we do, you know, and sometimes that gets overlooked in the rush of what kind of plant to get, but hopefully our discussion will help.
And sometimes cut flowers are best. So again, this would be best on best decided. This would be a decision driven by who's receiving the plant or the flowers.
That's right, because out of all the plant gifts that one could give, I would say cut flowers are the easiest to maintain. You can get a week or maybe 10 days out of them just by changing the water and using the little packet that they give you when you buy the flowers.
What's in the packet?
It's like liquid fertilizer.
And then, so what are some things we need to check off when it comes to deciding what kind of plant to give a particular person?
Well, we need to keep in mind, what are they going to do with it? Are they going to be able to take it home? Are they in a position to take care of it at all? You know, and a lot of the plants, they have a range of maintenance or attention that they require, some more than others.
Most of them, though, since they're going to be in the house, are fairly low maintenance. Is that accurate?
That is accurate in spirit. That's right.
In spirit. All right. So let's talk about some specific types of plants. What are the kinds of plants that we're likely to see on the shelf when it comes time to buy one to give as a gift?
I'm a big fan of the art and craft of bonsai, so we're going to start with that. And good news is that there are a lot of them available for sale during the Christmas holidays. And they come back again around Mother's Day when that kind of stuff is popular. But they're the most maintenance intensive. They require the most amount of attention.
And is that the pruning of this plant to make it look like a tiny tree or?
Well, that is a small part of actually having the bonsai. It's what you should know is that the bonsai are trained to grow in a dwarf fashion by living on a restricted root with restricted root growth and root development. So a lot of times you see the bonsai as this oversized plant or what appears to be oversized in a very small pot. And a lot of the ones that are retail sales items, they are the most common that people associate with bonsai. So there's some kind of conifer like a pine or a juniper or a cypress, which are outdoor plants. That's the problem. So they've glued the gravel on them. They're the little decoration, the moss and stuff is all glued to the top of the pot. That's to prevent it from coming loose during shipping and handling. And when you water a bonsai pot, you should submerge it in water rather than pour the water in from the top. So see, we're already getting into a long list of stuff that's right out of the owner's manual, and that's the hardest stuff to do for a lot of people.
I always thought orchids were fickle and sort of touchy.
They are. They are. And my wife and I received an orchid as a gift, and I have repotted it in the same pot that it came in. But it is suffering. It has been hard to keep it because they don't like the dry air that comes from the heating of the home. No matter where I put the thing, the leaves start to yellow and they like to go dry between waterings, you know, so they're very particular in that regard.
You have a window in the bathroom?
We have a east-facing window,
but we don't
have any bathroom windows.
Okay, I was going to say, I mean, that might give it the humidity it needs.
Right, right. Another way, Mike, to get the humidity is to have a tray full of pebbles, and then you put water in there, and then the pot's set on top of the pebbles. And then when the water evaporates, it gives those plants in close proximity some extra humidity.
So on the flip side, well, it likes to go dry between waterings as well. Then you have plants that need very little water, like cactus.
The cacti and the succulents, they're kind of next to each other on the list. They require less water, of course, and lots of light. And Christmas cactus are the easiest ones to take care of. I've seen Christmas cactus live in the nursery liner for years. And the succulents are things like agave and sedums and jade. They like a little more light, and you want to let those dry between waterings. And they're actually fairly easy to manage. You don't have to go out and find special soil for them necessarily. Cacti, orchids, and the bonsai, you sometimes have to have special soil. You just can't use what you've got left over.
Needs lots of drainage.
And the orchids like a coarser type of soil mix.
So with the succulents, what I found through trial and error, and it's ridiculous because I should have figured it out a long time ago, is I was just watering them too much. The more I leave the succulents alone that I have, the better they do.
Yeah, I've had that experience where we gave my mother-in-law, Mary Ann, we gave her a fiddly fig, Ficus lyrata. And in appreciation for receiving the gift, it was adopted into the house with lots of love and everything and a little too much water. And it started showing it right away on your tropical houseplants, which we're going to talk more about. When you see browning and blackening on the foliage, you got too much water.
And that was my problem. I thought, oh, well, it needs more water, right? It's having an issue. And actually, I was overwatering them. We bring our succulents in from outside. They spend spring and summer and most of fall outside. We bring them in for the winter, put them in east-facing windows, and I water them in February. I mean,
right.
That's it, right? I water them once over the winter.
Right, and they're really popular in interior decor now. The low troughs that are sometimes oversized, kind of a low flat centerpiece that you can see over the top of so you can speak with and serve your guests.
So tropicals?
Tropicals, they require varying levels of attention. And most do not like the dry air from the heating, just like the other plants. Some tough proven performers are things like Sansevieria, a common name known as the mother-in-law's tongue, poinsettias. They're very popular during the Christmas holiday, as they should be. They both like to dry between waterings. And one thing about the poinsettias and a lot of gift plants, they come with the foil, you know, and the foil kind of keeps the water from leaking out onto the carpet or whatever. But it's not necessarily a positive for keeping the plant long term. You want to kind of start thinking about repotting the tropical plants that you receive as a gift after you've had them for, say, a couple weeks up to a month.
And since we're talking about poinsettias, I guess we should talk about dogs, cats, other pets, children, and plants, and whether some of these plants are safe to be around animals and kids.
Yeah, there's some of the obvious hazards with things like cacti, right? They got the dog's little nose or the cat's little nose can get the quills in them really easy, and then you got to pluck them out with the nose hair tweezers.
Or little Jimmy's thumb.
Little Jimmy's thumb. Hey, I said don't touch that. And then, yeah, right. And there is a milky sap that you can see if you break a leaf off of poinsettia. It's toxic to everybody, but particularly the pets.
So when receiving the plant, should the recipient assume it's good to go for a while, or should they inspect it in some way, for instance, making sure it doesn't need to be repotted right away?
Yeah, a lot of these plants, when you receive them as a gift, are in a nursery liner type of pot with a very light soil mix. And this is intentional to reduce the weight for freight and handling. And it also is conducive to getting vigorous new growth during production. And sometimes there are more roots than soil in the pots. And the short soil productivity life is a result of that. So a lot of times you can repot right back into the same pot just by adding some newer soil or some more improved soil.
And a tree is kind of a big deal. You could gift a tree. I think it's a great idea, but you really need to talk to the person who's receiving this tree.
Yeah, and I don't think now is the season, but I wanted to include that because we're all big tree lovers here at Illinois State University and the Fell Arboretum. But it is a long-lasting gift.
Decades.
And, that's right, and it's a generational type gift.
If you have any questions about houseplants or anything in nature or gardening, submit them at wglt.org/grow. Next week, we'll talk about the frozen ground, something I didn't think we had to even consider, Patrick.
It's important here in the Midwest.
That's Patrick Murphy. I'm Mike McCurdy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
You can subscribe to the Grow Podcast at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. Karen Bridges and Clint Thompson of the folk duo Stone and Snow are on a roll with their original song, Love is a Weapon. The video for the song was recognized as one of the outstanding entries in the 2018 NPR Tiny Desk Concert. And a month ago, Stone and Snow learned Love is a Weapon won the 2018 John Lennon Songwriting Contest. That earned them a trip to Los Angeles to the National Association of Music Merchants Conference this Sunday to perform on the main stage. Bridges and Thompson stopped by the GLT studios to talk about the award with GLT's John Norton. Thompson says it's a big deal to be able to perform a 40-minute set of original music in front of music professionals.
So a lot of people, I've known about the NAMM show for a long, long time just through being a gear hound myself, you know. You watch videos and you see people at the NAMM show, so I think it's pretty cool to get to play there.
Exposure is exciting. I don't really know what to expect, though. I think that's maybe just my hesitation because I haven't been to NAMM yet. You hear about it when you learn. That's how you learn about new gear in the industry, really, is through that show. And that's exciting. But I have my expectations. I have no idea what we're in for.
It will be nice to be in California,
though. Yeah.
Yeah, late January. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
When you found out you won, did they comment specifically on the song?
They did. They said they had it playing nonstop in the office over at the Lennon Bus. So that was a little surreal.
Was there a commentary on the music and or the lyrics itself? Did they say why they liked it, in other words?
There was various things that came across on social media, which I'm not on there, but you saw. We had some good feedback from them, but yeah.
Well, then let's deconstruct the song, all right, and we'll give our listeners an idea of what this is all about, all right? Love is a Weapon is the name of the song. Can we just deconstruct the song? You okay with that?
Sure.
You guys all right? Who wrote the lyrics, first of all?
I did.
Are you the music writer then, Clint, or you team up on that?
Not on this one.
Oh, we did work on some of the instrumentation, but as far as the melody goes, I pretty much brought this one to him fairly fully formed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it started off really as something very personal about me wrestling with my own muses in a way, and I didn't really expect that it would become something so universally liked and something that people were drawn to.
Let's play the first verse then.
No, I can be a little overwhelming. It's hard and afraid to make it to the last price. Figure I'm paid to have my mule to know your name.
What is your muse in this case? Is it a person or is it a thing?
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, I'm not gonna. Nope. I don't know where to go from that. It's not really about any one muse, so I can't really point to that. Maybe I know what they are, but I don't want to say them out loud because I don't want them to lose their power.
Okay. Once you got the song out, was it cathartic for you?
Yeah, I think I was in kind of a block a little bit at the time, and to get that out helped me move forward and talk more about other things that's not just about songwriting itself, which I felt like this was what that song was to begin with, and just my creative process.
Love is a weapon. See if you can use it. 'Cause I don't want to fight like this anymore. 'Cause I don't want to fight.
Karen Bridges and Clint Thompson are Stone and Snow. This is their song, Love is a Weapon. They're performing this Sunday in Los Angeles as the grand prize of the John Lennon Songwriting Contest. They're performing it at the NAMM Show. I'm John Norton. This is GLT's Sound Ideas. Love is a Weapon is also the song you submitted for the NPR Tiny Desk Contest. And you've got some nice feedback for that as well. You got on the outstanding entries list that they put up on their website and obviously gave it some shout-outs. Two nice nudges here in the last year or so about this song specifically, but from national organizations that are recognizing that there's something going on here.
It's a little surreal. I didn't really think it would be something that people would care about because it seemed so personal to me at the beginning when I wrote it.
I guess from somebody on the outside looking in at this one, I think it was the timing of this song coming out, it couldn't come at a better time with, you know, the world the way a lot of things are today and all of the hate flowing around. So for me, that's been the importance of the song, is we don't have to focus on hate and we don't have to focus on the negative.
From what I hear from others, the interpretation is largely that it's about courage and about approaching conflict. I mean, there's always going to be conflict, and there is a lot of hate out there right now, but to approach things from a place of love and to use that as a way to fight rather than go with your base instincts and give in to hate.
I'm going to go back to the nudge. I mean, you guys play a lot locally and regionally, right?
Well,
when we can.
When we can. Yeah, right. Whenever it makes sense to play, we do, yeah.
Is this time to rethink what you're doing musically? Like, you do it on a bigger stage or on a, you know, on a wider stage?
Well, I think we're just going to take opportunities as they come. You get recognition for something, it doesn't automatically mean anything in particular, just that you're doing the right thing and you have to keep working. That may open us to make more connections. Obviously, we want to keep growing. We really don't know what to expect yet.
Hopefully, you're doing your thing. And you're working, And if something good like this comes along and happens, then great, you know, see where it goes. But you don't just stop and say, okay, this is going to take me to the next level. Just keep working, keep setting goals for yourself.
So is this really jump-started? We got to get back to even more songwriting and more recording now.
I think...
Rumor has it there's a new album in the pipeline here, too.
Yes. That is one of those goals I was just talking about, yeah.
Well, it's been 3 years since we've released material, and this song has been at the forefront of our thoughts as we move forward. We're going to record new material this year. This song will be featured prominently. We did hop into the studio recently to record this song, actually. We're going to offer it up as a single next month. We're going to do a pre-order campaign to get this album going, and we're looking at a summer release.
Karen Bridges and Clint Thompson of the Twin Cities folk duo Stone and Snow, speaking with GLT's John Norton. They'll perform this Sunday at the NAMM Trade Show in Los Angeles as one of the winners of the 2018 John Lennon Songwriting Contest. Discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas episodes and stories. With help today from John Norton, Mary Cullen, Mike McCurdy, and Patrick Murphy. I'm Ryan Denham, and you can subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas, so comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News, and I'm at Ryan WGLT. Let's send you off with a bit more of Stone and Snow. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. Bloomington Normal's public media.